And thanks for joining us now on KVCR for KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming, welcoming author Jane Kirkpatrick. Jane, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. And, you know, recently I spoke to a man by the name of Paul Brett, who authored a book about a fretless guitar, which once belonged to George Harrison. And that's a total sidebar if we were going to talk about this. But I heard him say to a crowd once that he had never been an author until he wrote a book. I'd like to hear about what you were doing before you wrote that first book.
I was in mental health full time, and I've been the director of a mental health program here in Central Oregon. And prior to that, did some work with people with disabilities. So that was kind of my specialty. And then I became the director. And then my husband and I took this total diversion in 1982 and moved to what I called Rattlesnake and Rock Ranch, which was 160 acres on a very remote section of North Central Oregon. And we were hoping to make a life there, which we did, actually. We lived there almost 30 years, but doing everything from getting power, you know, harnessing a spring to get water so you didn't have to call drinking water 30 miles and all this sort of stuff. And actually, it's then when I started writing, because we didn't have a phone, we didn't have power for quite a while. And most of our family and friends thought we had truly dropped off the end of the earth. So once we got power, I started writing letters and tried to keep them humorous. But one of our friends wrote back and said, when we get your letters, we don't read them right away. We wait until after supper and we turn off the TV and we read them out loud because they're like a chapter in a book. And that was sort of the opening for me to think, well, maybe I could write a book, not a how-to book, because everything that could go wrong did, but how to follow your heart, you know, even if all around you people are saying, you guys are crazy. And so that ultimately became the first book, which was a memoir called Homestead. That came out in 1991, and I thought, okay, I've written my book, I'm an author. But I began to be taken with historical stories of women. Yes. And their journeys on the Oregon Trail and in homesteading. And I was really struck by what their life might have been like. And I could get some biographies which would tell me what they did and when they did it. But fiction allowed me to think about why someone did something, the motivation, but also how they might have felt.
Yes.
So that was really an important part of who I became as a writer. So my first novel was about a woman here in Central Oregon and her husband and their journey and their life with the Wasco Warm Springs and Paiute people. And it happened that we were homesteading. I began working for that reservation, for that tribal affiliation, and did that for 17 years, commuting. And that worked out well for my writing life because I didn't have to feel guilty about working on things because I was away. My husband was, you know, on the ranch, and that sort of became my pattern. I would get up really early and write from 5 until 7 in the morning and then go to work. I did that 3 days a week, and then I would drive back home 2.5 hours to our ranch and put on another hat of what some friends just recently told me they referred to as stories about country women, which I thought was really a nice phrase. I was at an event in far eastern Oregon, which is largely still cowboy and very resilient rancher types. And one of the women told me that when my book come in to the library, they would all sign up for them. And then she said, and then we'd have to wait, and then they'd book up on the top shelf, and we couldn't get them until our name came up. And she said, and then we just fell in love with stories that we could relate to. I take that as high praise, really, because that was my hope, that people would find themselves inside the stories that I wrote.
Yes, indeed. I have to say, when you say country women, I'm thinking of Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton and whatnot, not so much. You're more Jane Chisholm and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the women that I write about were mostly Northwest. Some of them were a story of an early mental health reformer, Dorothea Dix, that primarily on the East Coast, but most of my stories are set on the West Coast. And those women were pioneers in many ways. That's a word that means taking steps ahead of someone else. And so that's what many of them did. And Natalie is an example of that, who lived a life very different than what the expectations were for her as a young woman in 1900.
Oh, without a doubt. And we will get to the healing of Natalie Curtis in just a bit. A little bit more just generally speaking. So when you were writing from 5 until 7:30, this time pass, in essence, at this point you weren't really writing to write per se. Were you just processing thoughts, much like a person journaling? Or was this actually a start at writing something formally?
After the memoir, there were a couple of years in there where I thought, oh, well, I've done what I'm going to do. But these stories of these women, and I kept asking questions, well, why would this happen? And how did she manage that? And the story, A Sweetness to the Soul, about a local woman here in Central Oregon, I thought it was a great story about her life and their pursuit of a dream. And there were some parallels with our lives, but I kept saying, well, I can't write that because I'd never written fiction, and I can't tell that story because it's not my family story, and I haven't lived here for 100 years in this community. And my husband said, if you think it's a great story, you should just write it down, and if people don't like it, they can write their own version. And I thought, well, that's sort of insightful. And so that's when I made the decision that I would just set the alarm at 4, and my commitment was to be at the computer at 5. And I didn't have to write a certain number of words, but just, you know, be there to show up 5. And the next day after he said that to me, we went to a historical society meeting, and I sat next to a man who said, and what do you do? And I said, I'm a writer. And it was the first time I had said it without any disclaimers. He said, well, what are you working on? I said, oh, I'm writing the story of Jane and Joseph Shear with their life with the Owasco, Warm Springs, and Paiute people. And I had not yet written one sentence, but I figured I had done the hardest work because I'd made the commitment. And he said, well, you should meet my cousin. And when I asked why, he said, well, she owns the property that their original homestead was on.
Oh.
And I'm sure she'd let you walk there. And she did. And I have to say that every book has had a moment like that, which is just kind of hair in the back of your neck. And I really think it's come from making that commitment. And there's a wonderful quote from Ben Goethe said, what people don't realize is that once you make a commitment to something, then providence moves and things begin to happen that you otherwise never could have imagined. That began that journey. And I did then work on writing the book, basically, telling that story and finding an agent and doing all the stuff that you do. And so we found a publisher, and then I convinced them that I could not only write that story, but I could write 3 other books about frontier couples, one of whom turned out to be a Florida frontier couple. That was my foray into a Floridian story. And they contracted with me for those 3 other books. So then I had convinced someone that these were great ideas. And then the horror was I didn't know if I could actually write them.
Oh.
And each book has been like that. I've pitched the story to a publisher, and the team has said, yeah, this sounds great. And then I have to every morning face that computer and go, why did I ever think I could do this?
Yeah.
So
it was actually first described to me, the book that you were just talking about, but I suppose this would apply to any of your works that we could put into the historical fiction category. The fact that you wanted to write a story about something that you knew of, whether it was a placard or someone gave a talk about this woman at a library event or whatever, the fact is that you wanted to write a story about something that you knew of, but there wasn't enough information. And so historical fiction gives you the absolute creative license to fill in those gaps, I suppose.
Yes, and actually it sort of fed my interest in research because they're wonderful little tidbits that really expand a story sometimes. And then there's the occasion in which, as with the Natalie story, the book came out, and a year and a half later, I was contacted by a great nephew who had read the book, and we have continued a relationship, which has just been a wonderful expansion of the writing of the book to explore other things, as in the screenplay that I wrote related to the Natalie story. So the research part, you write about something that you sort of have some experience with, but the whole thing opens up a whole new world when you explore the research and find out more things to fill in those gaps, as you mentioned, that
right.
You otherwise don't have any way of knowing.
Let's go to the healing of Natalie Curtis. Is this your latest, or I know it's at least close to your latest?
It came out in 2021, and then there was one after that, and then I just turned in my latest, and it'll come out in 2025.
Gotcha.
But the Natalie story was written during COVID, so that presented some research complications for sure, but it also wonderful journey of a mix of mental health and the arts. And a number of people have said as they've read the book that they thought it was going to be a story about how Natalie was healed from music.
Right.
But in fact, it became a story of how, yes, she was healed by music, but it was even more grand than that for finding a purpose in her life that helped heal her soul and her spirit as this classically trained musician.
Yes.
So it was a lovely opportunity to mix mental health and the arts. And it was also a book that was read by a group of painters in the Portland, Oregon area, and they were watercolorists, and they read the book, and then they painted their version of the book. And then we had this wonderful gathering of both indigenous people with their art and a huge sale of these wonderful paintings. And it was just such a great expression of the way in which the arts can meet us in places where nothing else can, whether it's therapy or, you know, anything.
Yes, indeed.
But the arts can be this great healing opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Truly, truly, in so many, many ways. Now, how did you come across the story of Natalie Curtis to begin with? Whether it was a small snippet or a part of a sentence and you had to find out more, how did you come across the story, and then what inspired you to want to share this story?
I went to a Women Writing the West, which is an organization that I belonged to for a number of years, and they had a conference that was held at the Ghost Ranch in New Mexico. I attended that, and one of the writers who was a presenter there was Leslie Tolan Kemp, is her name, and she had written a book called Ladies of the Canyon. It was a nonfiction book writing about these four different women, three of whom were from the East Coast, one of whom was from San Diego. But they were women who were quite wealthy, came from very established families, and there were expectations of their lives that they should behave in certain ways as young women, and they should get married and have children and, you know, lead normal lives. And all of them defied those expectations in their own way. And Natalie Curtis was one of them. She was a classically trained musician. There were affiliations with Teddy Roosevelt, who at the beginning of the story is the Secretary of Navy, but then he becomes President of the United States. The unanswered question was, how did that happen? How did this woman, who was classically trained, end up coming out to the West and finding herself an Indian advocate who was trying to preserve and save Indian arts, including music, which at the time had been prohibited from the tribes from being able to perform. So that's how I learned about it, and that story kind of sat in the back of my mind. That was 2011, actually. And I purchased her book that Natalie had written called The Indians Book, and then just sat on the story, and eventually it burbled up to the place where I felt I had to tell that story, because it just seemed so powerful of what one person could do and how the arts were so important for the healing of our spirits and of culture. I mean, bringing culture into a place that is not divisive, but is actually a place to bring us together.
Well stated. I'm David Fleming in conversation with author Jane Kirkpatrick about a recent work of historical fiction, The Healing of Natalie Curtis. You just mentioned the singing. In addition to that, the dancing and speaking of their own language, this was with the goal of assimilation. And so Natalie was shocked by this. I'm glad you, by the way, spoke about the title, because that was one of the first things that struck me and wondered about, is the double meaning within the title, the healing that Natalie herself was trying to get for herself and the healing that she ended up bestowing upon others. But there's a point in this when she's about to meet, quote, actual native people, I think it says, but she goes to a notebook out of her bag and she found a page where she'd written something. And I'm going to read it right now. If I were to wish for anything, I should not wish for wealth and power, but for the passionate sense of the potential, for the eye, which ever young and ardent, sees the possible. Pleasure disappoints. Possibility, never. She's quoting Kierkegaard on that, and I want to know if this is Jane Kirkpatrick saying, hey, Kierkegaard would be cool to throw in here, or did you find out that Natalie Curtis indeed was into Kierkegaard and appreciated his works and philosophy?
I did not find out that specific, that it was Kierkegaard, but I did find out, and partly this was through a very detailed biography that was written by a woman who wrote her doctoral dissertation on Natalie, that she was very much into the philosophers, that she really was exploring beyond just traditional concepts that young women in the early 1900s were expected to pay attention to. She was a much deeper thinker. Her brother, who was obviously an incredibly important person in her life, who basically convinced her to come west and who also traveled with her while she was writing this book, sort of gave up his life in order to support her journey. He had been the head of the library in New York and also very well educated Harvard graduate. And so speaking of philosophers, especially for women, was somewhat out of the ordinary, but it was very fitting for Natalie's expanding the expectations for what a woman was capable of doing and thinking.
Expanding is that such a better word than violating, I think.
Yes, definitely. Expanding. And one of the books I was writing had to do with a woman in the late 1800s. She and her daughter walked across the United States to prove that women were strong enough to do that. It was 1897, which is about the same time that Natalie had her collapse. But one of the comments that I came when I was doing research said that until a woman gets control of her ankles, she'll never have control of her brain. That literally women who went to college, if they came home and had the flu, the cause was attributed to, well, they were trying to expand their brains too much, and women couldn't tolerate that. So many women were not allowed to go back to college if they came home sick for break or whatever. So that's what women like Natalie were dealing with in terms of a cultural expectation, that their brains just couldn't expand enough to think things like what a philosopher would say. And these women that walked across from Spokane to New York, part of what their journey was, they had to earn their way across the country. And when they got to Salt Lake City, they changed into different clothing that was more, you know, you could ride bicycles, and they gave up their corsets, and they showed their ankles.
How lewd.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what Natalie came into. So her decision to not go back to the East and to make a life in the West was really quite remarkable. That was part of why I wanted to tell this story, to explore what gave her the confidence and courage after her meltdown, basically in 1897. How did she make her way back to find herself as this Native American advocate and a woman who stood out because she was willing to be different?
Was she looked at, say, by the folks that were still back east? And maybe they were even looking at her brother like this as well, since he supported her and traveled with her. Was she just totally looked at as this ankle-showing harlot?
I don't think they were well supported at the time in that journey. And eventually, they were able to get sponsors. She got sponsors because she really focused on the great cultural loss, whether it's music or pottery or fabric arts that they were known for, if those were lost. And the Code of Indian Offenses that was passed in 1883 was initially meant to help define what were actual crimes on a reservation, which were federal, as opposed to the state that they were in. But opportunistic Indian agents took that to be, well, we can restrict Indian practices. So the giving of gifts at weddings, we can stop that. You know, the non-Indian tradition is you give gifts to the wedding couple, but in many Native tribes at a wedding, gifts are given away. And so, or religious ceremonies and so on. And so that's part of that grew into this, well, people should not be allowed to sing or dance or use their native language. And obviously that was the goal, ultimately, was to assimilate and to wipe out an ethnocide, if you want to call it that, which some people did at the time. that code is really what Natalie was working against. And she was using what she knew about Teddy Roosevelt as a family friend who cared about culture. That's how she approached him, is that we cannot have a truly American culture if the very basis of the people who were here first are lost. And somehow he got that message, which, if you study your history, he was not a supporter of Native Americans.
You're right.
He said some pretty terrible things, very racist things. So she found a way, and I think that was another gift that she had, was to somehow be able to imagine what someone would be able to accept that would also move forward what her goal was, which was to eliminate the impact of that code of Indian defenses.
So there are some things that happen in the book here and there. Sometimes it's a little thing, like you just casually write down that as he's speaking with her, he crushes some mint leaves into a water glass and drank it. And there's really nothing about the story that has to do with, okay, mint leaves and a water glass. But what you've just done is placed us in a point in time where this is an action that you might do. Don't want water, but of course you can't go out and buy a limeade soda. So you do this kind of thing. So talk to me about, please, some other places in the book, scenarios which, well, you made up, but it really is something that does indeed happen. One thing, for example, let's say Natalie is talking with some folks about the produce they got, I think, from the Yuma people. This may have been the warden and his wife at this prison. And she's encountering conversation about how, quote, these people are unclean and we have to wash everything twice before using it. And Natalie was very surprised. She understood that people who lived far away and didn't know anything about this particular people might have some prejudicial type of thinking. But she was very surprised that this type of prejudice would be encountered among people who lived right there with these people. But there it was. It happens. Did you make it up completely, or did you find instances in some of Natalie's writings about when she was at the prison and found these people to be prejudicial types of people, you know, that sort of a thing?
I didn't have to make it up. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
And part of the setting, the landscape, the relationships, there are sort of four threads will run through most of my work, and they are the landscape, relationships, spirituality, the journey that people are on to find meaning in their life, and their work. And so those four threads are constantly, you know, moving through my own writing. And it's those small moments, like the crushing of the mint leaves, was significant in that that was something that people could use. And the mint grew at a certain altitude in Arizona, and it was used by Native people to help pack the mutton and keep it fresh for when they traveled. It seemed important to me to identify some of those practices that were interesting, but also told without telling, to tell a reader about this place and about these people, the relationship they had with their environment. The instance with the people at the prison, there clearly were people, and to this day, who have this vision of what it is like to be on a reservation, who have probably never been on one. And there is an assumption about, oh, well, it's dusty and dirty, and so therefore the people are dusty and dirty, which is a leap that people would make, and particularly during that time. The Bureau of Indian Affairs has reports that the agents had to send in every month about what was going on their watch, basically. And that's where some of those would show up, both the bias of the agent, but also maybe their practice to try to prevent some of that negative thinking. And the Indian agent for the Yuma, part of what I wanted to portray is he was really a difficult man for Natalie to have to deal with. But he also got fencing so that they could help keep the goats and the sheep out of the orchard. And the orchards were beautiful, and they had wonderful fruit. And the prison officials would get that fruit, and they would trade for that, and that was something that helped supplant their food supply. And yet, because it came from the reservation, there was that assumption that, oh, well, this is, you got to wash it three times because otherwise it won't be good. And Natalie caught that. I think she was very intuitive. She was a great observer of the human condition. And so I wanted to portray that she was not experiencing what the warden's wife was experiencing. Yeah. And sadly, the warden's wife missed out on a whole lot of interesting things that could have enhanced her life because of that.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Let's talk just a little bit about your website, jkbooks.com, works, news, and events. Talk about what are the story sparks, please.
So I started writing a newsletter about 30 years ago and including it on my website, and eventually it became an email, basically, to people who had signed up. So Story Sparks is a newsletter that sort of hopefully is a work of encouragement. It includes some book reviews. It talks about events that I have coming up, and hopefully just share some stories for people about the positive things that happen in our lives. It's fairly personal. I write a lot about my husband and his many health issues, and the dogs sometimes have a column and speak out about their life with a writer. And then I archive them on the website so people miss them. But I have a pretty good percentage of opening with the newsletter. I think the Constant Contact that does the newsletter, and they give you data, and I think I have about an 85% opening. So when the newsletter comes, 85% of the time it's opened, and people actually either read it or open it before they delete it, one or the other. But and the comments I get are that it's an encouraging moment for them. It just is a reminder that there are things worthy of taking time to notice and to care about in the world around you and to pay attention to the good things that are happening.
Okay. For this edition of KVC Arts, I've been speaking with author Jane Kirkpatrick. We've been speaking mainly about one of her most recent work of historical fiction called The Healing of Natalie Curtis. Many more books from Jane at jkbooks.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Jane, as well as to Sandy Hodala, for getting this one going. Here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Miley Palacios, and Sharina Watt. And a big, big thanks also to Lillian Vasquez, who just retired from KVCR. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts. Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Be sure to check out our calendar of events in the region at our homepage, kvcrnews.org, or you can go directly there at kvcrnews.org/calendar. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.